This is an oral history recording on the 21st of October 2014 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist,
Tom Edlin, history department,
and
Frank Herman, Old Westminster.
Perfect. Do you want to start or shall I?
Well, Frank, I was reading the earlier sections of your book yesterday, and I thought we should start by asking you about your early childhood and your memories of Germany. There's one particular story that you tell about your memory of being in school in, I think, was it 1935, which is amazing to read as a historian, with the teacher making those strongly anti-Semitic remarks and your response to that. I wondered if you might be able to tell us a bit more about those early memories of Germany in the 1930s.
Well, I ought to tell you something for a start. My memory of early childhood is not as good as most English authors. When you read English literature, people seem to remember everything that happened to them after they were 3 and a half. I have patches and scenes, but I don't remember the whole thing on a continuous basis. Would you like to shut that door? But I do remember that particular scene, and I can still actually visualize the classroom and the children and the teacher, and the look of horror on the face of the teacher when I protested that not all Jews were bad, and my grandfather was particularly good. And they all tried to sort of hush it up, but in fact it all got out, and the poor headmaster who tried to protect me got sacked, and I had to leave the school. But what happened after that, I don't remember, except we had a very beautiful apartment in a part of Berlin called, this is where my men's begin to go, in a part of Berlin called Helfenfreistrasse. I haven't got the exact memory. And lying in the front bedroom was my very ancient great-grandmother, who had been blind for much of her life, or the tail end of her life, and she had just been operated on for cataract, which was a new thing, and she was lying there. I think she was 84 at the time, and I used to turn up every morning and chat to her. I can remember precisely seeing her in bed and the sort of sunlight coming in the morning. Now, those are the sort of things I can remember. If that's of helpful, I don't know.
It's very helpful. I mean, it's a wonderful, vivid memory,
yes,
of those moments, which I think is so powerful. You must have grown up when you were a very small boy with a lot of family around you then.
I don't remember that at all, no. I hardly remember my parents' presence in this apartment, except it was on a top floor, and there was a very big sort of garden veranda at the top, and it was big enough for me to go around on a scooter. And there were many accidents. But curious enough, I had no recall of my parents at that stage. And then, if you remember, they started planning their departure to England.
Mm.
And really, there was a sort of gap until I got to Switzerland.
Mm.
And I enjoyed Switzerland. We were staying in a sort of children's home, which was good for my asthma. I don't particularly remember having asthma. that my brother and I were left alone while my parents prepared their exodus from Germany, which also meant that they had to pay huge fines to be allowed to get out. And all I know in general is that my father had to buy a farm in Southwest Africa and transfer his money there so it wouldn't all be taken from him. And I still have all the files, but they fill me with gloom when I read them, so on the whole I don't. And Switzerland, I was there with my brother, we shared a room, and the biggest event of our presence there were two things. One is we had ping pong bats, and my brother wanted one, and I threw it over to him, and it hit him on the forehead and left a scar. So he always thought I did it on purpose, but of course I hadn't. And the other thing was that we learned skiing and tobogganing. I'm not sure about skating. I don't remember skating much. But there's a very big hotel beneath the children's home where we were, called the Suvretta Hotel, which is still there. And on one particular occasion, the king of Egypt and all his sisters took over one floor. And of course they weren't any good at skiing. And they all went on the road, and each of the sisters was supported by two skiing teachers. And my brother and I were sitting on a toboggan, going at a good lick, and we couldn't stop when we shouted, "They should get out of the way." So we knocked over two of the Egyptian princesses and carried on to the nearest village. And then I remember being driven across Europe by the man who ran the children's home and the sort of matron. For all I know, they were sort of an item. And we drove through part of France where the Maginot Line was. And I remember vividly the man who owned the children's home saying, "Look at that, boys, that's the Maginot Line. That'll stop the Germans whenever there's another war." And then after that, sort of memories of that part of my life fade, and I started in England. Do you want me to go on?
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering how aware do you think you were at that stage of what was going on in Germany and in Europe as a whole?
No, not really.
Yeah.
In Switzerland we were entirely kept away from it, and my parents wrote to me quite frequently, but that sort of thing wasn't mentioned. But it was a strange time, because my grandparents, who were also in theory, my mother's parents, were in theory Jewish, but not by religion, but by background. And we have got the entire correspondence and diaries which my grandmother kept, because my grandfather was already too old to cope with it. And she negotiated with the Nazi authorities, herself personally, who'd never done anything more except fixing the menu for Sunday lunch. And she carried on for 2 years and got it all organised until they were able to leave Germany as well. And my grandfather was known for saying, "I've never hurt these people, why should they hurt me?" But it was borne unto him that things weren't as simple as that. When I got to England, I was put straight away into a prep school called Lee's House. My parents had been helped by my father's cousin, who was English. He was a barrister, and he was called Maxwell Wimpole, which was a very clever transliteration of Maximilian Wimpheimer. And he, poor chap, had been caught in Germany at the beginning of the war without a passport, because you didn't really need passports at that stage. And so he was interned at a famous internment camp called Ruhleben, which was a race course. And being bright, he became the camp librarian and got something at the end of the war on the strength of it. But he never worked again. His father was still alive, and he retired to the south of France, where he kept going by being a brilliant bridge player and winning a lot of money that way. And we still have a little ashtray next door, which was one of the many prizes he got. Well, I'm rather wandering now, but anyway, at the prep school, to my own astonishment, and I find it difficult to believe it now, I seem to learn English at an amazing pace. And I remember a sort of anecdote that when my father said to me, "Do you know all the boys in your class?" I said, "Yes, all except one. I can never find out who he is." And so my father said, "What is he called?" And I said, "He's called Silence." And I mean, there are one or two other sort of things that stick out. There was a school uniform, and it was possible to buy it at Peter Robinson, as it was then. And they had a special day when they sold all school uniforms at half price. And my father had bought an English car, an Austin 12. And you can imagine the chaos he created when he left his car just outside Peter Robinson in the middle of the traffic. And when the school uniform had been bought, he came downstairs and there was a policeman standing by the car. And the policeman said, "Excuse me, sir, is that your car?" And my father said, "Yes." And the policeman said, "How long have you been here?" And my father thought for a moment and said, "Since the 21st of June." We lived in Hampstead Garden suburb, which was a lovely place to live. And we lived in, there are two squares, North Square and South Square. And North Square had a huge free church, and South Square had a huge Anglican church called St. Jude's. And my parents' house was shared with the manse where the clergyman of the free church lived. And over the first 2 years before the war, we got to know almost all the residents in North Square. Number one family at number one was called Levitas. And Mr. Levitas dealt in bicycles to India. And they had two children called John and Margaret, with whom I remained friendly for years and years. And next to them lived the Minar Craigs. And so whatever Minar Craig he was called was a Scottish barrister who worked at the Scottish office devising laws. And he had a habit of singing in a very deep bass, a very loud voice, every morning when he shaved, and we all waited for this event. And the next people, I can't remember what they were called, and then there was us at number 4 North Square. And next to us was a very charming man who was a professor of French at King's College in London. Mm. And he had a very charming wife who was French as well, and she never learned to speak English properly. And her father was still alive, and her father and my mother got on terribly well, and the father came over and helped my mother with the gardening, which she had never done before, but she became a wildly enthusiastic gardener, specializing in alpine gardening. And before she died, she won a whole lot of prizes for growing the most extraordinary alpine plants in England, particularly alpine cyclamen, where she won some enormous prize for growing the best cyclamen, which went all over the world. And she got on terribly well with all the dealers in alpine plants and really enjoyed that enormously. But I've left out a bit. When I finished at Lee's house, well, I can go on going around the square. One of the most important people was a chap called Taylor, and he did those famous posters for the railways, which were very simple and clear, saying go to Clacton.
Oh yes, or Skegness.
Yes, exactly. And he had a studio which I occasionally was allowed to visit and watch him painting. And next to him was a Quaker meeting house. And the Quakers were very good with German refugees. They tended to look after them. And there were various ladies whose name, I'm afraid I can't remember anymore, who were very helpful to my parents. And on the number six was a delightful lady called Mrs. Kaufman, who was a widow. And she was quite sort of strict with youngsters like myself. But poor thing, she had 2 sons and a daughter. And both the sons got killed during the war in the last week, which she seemed to get over, and she had a very beautiful daughter, I think called Angelica, who was very helpful to my family too, and was brilliant at acting. And on the other side of the road, going downhill towards Temple Fortune, Finchley Road, was a man whose name I've forgotten, but he ran the motor company called Standard. Mm-hmm. And he and my father had great conversations about what car my father should buy. And my father collected all the catalogues of everything, which I recently sent to an auction house, where I'm absolutely delighted to have these things because they mostly disappeared. And next to him was a man called Robbins, who was a professor at London School of Economics. He was very serious. And there was another one whose name I can't remember. But primarily, there were the clergyman's family of the Free Church whose house was shared with ours. Mm. There's a picture in here, do you remember?
Mm. Yes, it's a sort of, yes. Sort of semi-detached, really.
Huh?
The two halves of the building.
Yes.
Yeah. It sounds like it was a real community, North
Absolutely.
Square.
Very much so. Also many strong adherents of what's the famous socialist organisation called?
Fabian Society. Huh? Fabian Society.
Fabian Society, yes. Yeah. Strongly supported. Well, there was my mother, actually still looking quite pretty, and with her father. Mm. I'll tell you about him later if you want to know. And there's me in tails about to
yes,
go to hospice.
About to go, yes, yes. Which we must talk about next.
That was... Oh, no, actually, I'm wrong. I made a mistake. That was the second house. That was 4 North Square.
Yeah.
The first house was 14 North Square.
Ah, so you moved.
And they moved.
Yeah.
During the war.
Mm.
My father bought this house for £2,000 and he had to pay a bit more for 999-year lease and a garage, and it's recently been sold for £2.5 million.
Mm.
And this is the family. That's the clergyman.
Oh, yes.
Who I was talking about. And that's his wonderfully scatty wife called Ahabala. That's my father, and that's Luke, my brother. Mm. Look, that was the first house. That was 14. That was our house,
and that's
where the clergy
yes,
is.
Yes, I'm not sure.
Now I get things muddled up, you can see.
No, don't worry about that. You showed us the picture just then of yourself in your tails ready to go to Westminster. Do you remember why your parents decided that Westminster would be the right
yes,
school?
Yes, I think they had friends who my mother asked, and she had heard about Westminster before, and she was quite determined that we should go there. I'm not sure why, but she worked very hard to get me in, and she had an interview with John Christie, and funnily enough, John Christie and my mother clicked in the most amazing way, not in a sexual way, but they just got on incredibly well and continued to do so right till the end of his life. And there was a family whose name I don't remember who knew John Christie, and they took my mother to see him. But that was all, of course, before the war.
Mm.
And it was all arranged. But actually, in fact, I moved to Westminster in summer 1940,
yes,
after the war had started.
Mm.
And except for 1 week when I worked in the boiler house of the Abbey, because that was considered safe, I never went to Westminster.
Mm.
In 5 years, and grew up a country boy in Hereford, which was actually probably a very good strengthening adventure.
Yes, yeah.
Because things were down to the basics. There was a long period when... Oh, I remember when my parents went to meet John Carlton, because I was going to go to Busby's, and they went down to... Sussex, I believe, where the school went first or something.
Was it Lancing?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was a terrible snowstorm, and so they couldn't get home. So they got to know John Carlton extremely well as well. And I mean, I remember vaguely that the fees per term were, I think, £139 for a boarder. But being registered as a day boy and still being a boarder in Herefordshire, I had to pay less.
Ah, that's rather cunning. That's very cunning.
Well, it wasn't me who arranged it. And then when I actually went to Westminster to start was in the summer term, 1940, and there were three of us at Busby's who arrived there simultaneously. One was a chap called Stephen Semple, who's recently died, whose distinguishing characteristic was he always licked his fingers like that. And he became a very distinguished children's surgeon.
Oh, I hope he didn't lick his fingers when he was doing surgery.
He gave it up. And the other chap was called Willis. And Willis was fat and amazingly teasable. And Mr. Willis, his father, built organs, the famous Willis organs. And Willis was teased so much that he gave up after a term and withdrew from the school. But Semple and I stayed. And I remember... What do I remember? Oh, I remember being in the dormitory at Button Hill, where I think there were 14 of us. And Button Hill, as you may have heard before, was really a ruin. And, I mean, it was literally true that there were creepers going through the floor in the dining room. There were no baths. There was little in the way of kitchen. And John Christie, who really wasn't the ideal person, had to take decisions on all these moves, which were, of course, incredibly expensive. And financially did the school no good at all. But we gradually settled down, and we went to school in two different places, which you may remember. First of all, we went to Saltmarsh Castle, where we had to walk across a mile and a half of fields, including a very narrow bridge over a big stream. Saltmarsh Castle was absolutely the ideal Gothic castle of about 1830, and it was owned and run by a man called Barnaby. And Mr. Barnaby had enough land to walk to the Welsh coast without ever leaving his own land. And I remember Mr. Barnaby. He was white-haired, and he was very pleasant, and he had a butler. And every morning when we went there, there was milk and biscuits at 11. And Mr. Barnaby loved talking to the boys, and the butler served the milk and biscuits.
Golly.
The tuition. There's a chap called Graham Dixon on the television.
Yes.
Who must be the son of another old Westminster.
He is, yes.
And the old Westminster, Graham Dixon, and I were bottom of the transters for a whole year. So you can see we weren't very distinguished. Is the old Graham Dixon still alive?
I think he may have died quite recently, actually.
Yes, I'm not sure.
Well, I've written to your development office about their latest annual sort of account. And I've never written to her before, but it seemed to me she was very keen to know from people she'd never heard of what they were up to. So I sent her a long note. And I was particularly spurred on to do this by the fact that there were 7 people who died in that issue with whom I'd been at school. And it suddenly showed me that I was one of a rare tribe who was still sort of going. We went to classrooms at Saltmarsh upstairs, where there were dozens of unused domestic rooms. And I don't remember much about the teaching, except there was no geography teacher. So I never knew any geography.
There are worse things.
Until I started travelling about. The master whom I remember, well, there was a man called John Willard. He was senior master. And when he retired, I bought his bicycle.
Oh.
Which was very tall.
That's good.
And then there was Major Troutbeck.
Yes.
He was classics. As far as I remember, he was completely hopeless, but very well versed in the way of Westminster. And then there was another chap called Bonnot, who was a modern language master. And the thing is that John Christie and Mrs. Christie and my mother all lived in a pub in Bromyard called the King's Arms. And there were several evacuees. There was Lord and Lady Strabogie, who gave themselves airs. He was a famous Labour peer. And then there was the mother, a rather handsome widow, of a boy called Dick Jones, Mrs. Jones. I don't know what Mrs. Jones was up to, but it wasn't much. It wasn't very desirable. And my mother. And there may have been one other person. Anyway, they all got to know each other very well because they met at breakfast. And when Mr. Bonnot became ill with pneumonia, John Christie appeared at my mother's room in the King's Arms and said, "Gubby, you speak French, you speak English, you speak quite a lot of Italian, you speak German, come and teach modern languages." And there was this astonishing scene when boys said to me, "Did you know that your mother was teaching at Button Hill? And she was wearing a fur cape and a red hat, I remember. And she got on extremely well. She started collecting foreign language grammars, and she obviously taught very well, because she kept up with some of the boys for years afterwards, including Tony Wedgwood Benn.
Right.
She and he corresponded for, what, 10, 15 years after they left. And we've got a famous library here in Walden called the Plume Library, founded in 1704 by a clergyman who not only set up the library and a grammar school here, but also started the Plumian Professorship in Cambridge, both of which are still going strong. And now why did I get on to him?
Wedgwood Benn? And
John Wedgwood Benn, yes, well done. And we got Wedgwood Benn to come here several times to speak. And he was absolutely brilliant. He would speak in the local grammar school, which is called the Plume School. It's not a grammar school, but it's a big secondary school. And he would speak an hour and a quarter or whatever without a single note. And we said to him, you can talk about anything you like as long as you avoid politics. And he was very good. I didn't take to his wife, who was too ardently Labour for my liking. And then the other people we got to talk, the Plume Library, just worth mentioning, just across the valley, there lived a family called Spender. And this particular Spender was called Humphrey Spender, who was an artist, a quite distinguished artist, and particularly famous as the photographer for, what's that organisation called that photographs places all over?
National Geographic?
Huh?
National Geographic? Or?
No. If you can find Patricia, she'll tell you. Anyway, they left all their stuff to Sussex University. And we got Humphrey Spender and Stephen Spender here on several occasions. And my son took, I think it's a photograph in there, of them. And they went down very well indeed, too. I can't remember, but anyway.
Your mother must have been one of the, well, she must have been the first female teacher at
yes.
Westminster.
Yes. Yes, must have been.
Yeah.
And when the school came back to London, she went on working for the under school for many years.
Yes. She must have enjoyed it. She must have really enjoyed
teaching. Loved it. And believe it or not, although, do you know what she was paid for teaching 4 days a week? She was paid £100 a month, or something absolutely terrible. And when she died, she left the school several thousand pounds to put into their music teaching. Mm. So she absolutely loved it, and teaching transformed her life. And when she eventually left Westminster, she went on teaching a lot of other people. And after the war, we had a very close friend who lived near Goldsbean Station called Sir Nicholas de Villiers, who was one of the bosses of the occupation forces. And they all needed to learn German. And this was another man with whom my mother got on extremely well. And she had classes for all the senior bods who went to Germany to organise things after the war. So teaching was something she really loved. Deep breath. Now, do you want me to go on?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Was it controversial for your mother to teach German at school during the war?
Well, that was one of the most extraordinary things. I was such easy meat to be teased, you know, Hermann the German. But hardly anybody ever did. It was quite amazing. I think it was a part of the good Westminster spirit. I ought to tell you two more things about Westminster in evacuation. There were two places where the teaching took part. One of them was this Saltmarsh Castle, and the other half of the school was in a place called Whitmore Court, which was in Worcestershire. And the journey from Buckton Hill to Whitbourne was 5 miles, and during one of the it was the most incredibly beautiful little roads, all gated, and sort of back roads. And one of the things on the way was an amazingly steep hill, and there were innumerable casualties when people cycled down and didn't stop in time. So we were given orders that we had to wheel our bicycles down there. And in contrast to Button Hill, Whitmore Court was very civilized. I don't know what it had been before, but it had certainly been occupied. And there were two places in Whitbourne. There was Whitbourne Court and another house in Whitbourne where grants were. Whitbourne Court was mostly the scholars. Well, anyway, it all went on, and then the decision just came, what was I going to do? And John Christie, who was known as Legs, said to my mother he ought to go to Magdalen. And for some idiotic reason, I had taken up science. And the ridiculous thing is, I won 2 science prizes. I've forgotten what they're called, but there's a sort of annual prize for a scientific essay. And I won that, and I won another one. But really, at bottom, I was absolutely bloody hopeless at science.
Was it more the essay writing on the scientific theme that you liked, rather than the experimental?
Yes, I did an essay on enzymes.
Right.
I seem to remember. Which went terribly well. I don't know whether I copied it from the right book or what. Anyway, so it was decided that I would go up to Magdalen and I would read science. And actually I got on quite well with chemistry, but I was absolutely hopeless at physics and math, particularly advanced math, which was completely beyond me. Are you good at math?
Well, I never did advanced maths. I wouldn't like to say. Probably not.
Anyway, the man who was in charge of Magdalen was called Sir Henry Tizard.
Yes,
who was
of course,
a famous
great Westminster
scientist and I think advisor to Churchill or something.
Yes, he was on a number of wartime committees, wasn't he?
And we seemed to get on quite well, but it became clear to me that I wasn't going to get through my prelims, because I'd never do the physics. I got through my prelims in chemistry without any problems, and so the sad moment came when I was told, really, you better do something else, which Tizard did very politely. And what was... Oh, well, that's another interesting chapter. When I was at Busby's, we had a fortnightly house paper called The College Declaring, which you have several copies.
Yes.
And I enjoyed reading it, and even more, I enjoyed writing for it. And it was put together in a little bungalow outside the Button Hill building where we did the typing under the aegis of P.D. Fisher, our housemaster. And we put it all together page by page and stapled it and got it sent off. And the subscription was threepence an issue. And I really enjoyed doing that work, and I eventually became editor of the College Declarer. And so it became clear to me that I really rather liked the book world. And so I set about, this must be the end of 1944, trying to get into publishing. And I wrote to 42 publishers, and only about 2 replied, saying, we'd love to have you if you had experience. And my reply had to be, well, if I had experience, life would be easier for me too. And the another boy at school, who was actually head boy, was Tom Faber. No, not Tom, something else Faber. He was red-haired and he had a beautiful voice. And we got on quite well, I don't know why. And when I couldn't get in anywhere, I said, I think I must have written to him and said, may I see your father about publishing? And I had a wonderfully well-contrived letter to all these others. I applied to 42 publishers, and I thought that if I ever write a biography, an autobiography, I ought to call it No Entry. Anyway, I saw him, and Geoffrey Faber told me that my letter was no good, and he changed it. I think he made it much worse. But the fact was that a few weeks after I'd seen him, somebody at Faber's called Thompson had to go to Switzerland on an asthma cure. And Geoffrey wrote to me saying, we're going to have a short time hole. You can come and work in our production department. And so I did. And I loved working in the production department. And the first thing I had to do was to cut up the plates and mount them properly for a book on English Delftware. All that is English Delftware. And you can see, Trisha will show you some more. And so I joined Faber's and was pitched straight into things that became very important in our life. And I left Faber's after 9 years. So it was a long temporary. Mm.
Yes, not very temporary at all.
And when I was called Arthur Thompson, who was a very delicate chap, but he had the most beautiful blue eyes, and the girls all fell for him in a big way. And when he came back, I said to David Bland, who was in charge of Faber's production department, what shall I do when Arthur Thompson comes back? And he made the classic response saying, oh, if you will find yourself a desk somewhere, you can stay.
And you did.
So I did for a long time. I love Faber's. My immediate boss was this chap, David Pan, who wrote a famous book on the illustration of books, two of them, in fact. And his boss was Richard de la Mer, son of the poet. Richard de la Mer was a senior director of Faber's, and his brother ran the Book Society. And at Faber's, about halfway through, Patricia was taken on, and we sat next to each other for 3 years before we even really began to talk to each other. And we were worked at a fantastic pace. I mean, people nowadays look after three books and think they're overloaded. Each of us in the production department had to look after between 30 and 40 books. And several of us got ill because the pressure was very gentle but rather amazing. And I had to retire for, I think it was nearly 3 months. And during that time, Patricia came and saw me, and we gradually fell in love. And then we finally got engaged on a visit to the V&A in the porcelain department, which has been with us ever since. I mean, the whole, it's what I gave a lecture the other day about a lady called Lady Charlotte Driver. She gave the V&A their biggest collection of porcelain. And I very much admired her. And well, we started collecting Telfair on £4 a week. Yes, £4 a week, what favours paid me for the first several years, and eventually, when we got married, it went up to £8 a week. And Patricia wasn't allowed to work at Faber's because they weren't allowed, in theory, to have husband and wife in the same department.
Ah.
So Patricia became an independent editor and worked extremely hard for Faber's. And there's a famous story there, which I think is in the book, that she used to call at Faber's at 24 Russell Square once or twice a week, and she would leave her oldest daughter, who was called Camilla, in the pram outside, and there was a receptionist, a funny little duck of a person called Miss Swan. And she would say to Miss Swan, "I've just left Camilla outside, keep an eye on her." And then she would go and talk to David Bland. And one day when she came back, there was no pram and no baby. Do you know the story?
No, go on.
And anyway, great panic. Patricia rushed in and said, "The pram's gone, no Camilla." Oh, and Miss Swan said, "I forgot to tell you, Mr. Elliot came in this morning, and he saw that Camilla had kicked off all her blankets, so he tucked her in again, and he's wheeling around the square."
As in T.S. Eliot?
T.S. Eliot.
Wow.
And I suppose that was a vicarious form of parenthood. Anyway, we lived on the story for a long time. Well, I think you ought to ask me another question.
Yes, I was just wondering if we could go back and talk about John Christie a little bit more, connected, of course, also with the book about John Christie, which...
John Christie is a very strange man. I was extremely impressed by him. He had tremendous, personality.
Mm.
Come on, find the word.
Charisma?
Charisma, well done. But I've been thinking about it. He was really a mix-up with very strong Victorian sense of right and wrong, with very advanced thinking about teaching. I was terribly impressed by him as a personality, and particularly, of course, his friendship with John Christie and John Christie's wife brought us together more. I think he was the ideal person not to have been in charge of Westminster during the war, because he was not really an administrator. He was basically a brilliant teacher. I was only taught by him once when we were preparing for O-level Latin, which I think we'd all failed, and he made us do one particular piece translated, and we didn't do it well enough, so he made us do it a second time. And then, as luck would have it, we got it in the O-level exam. So I did well in Latin. I think the school has never taken him as seriously as he deserved. I mean, when you compare John Carlton with him, John Carlton, did you know him?
Not personally, no.
Was infinitely smooth.
Yes.
Absolutely the ideal socialite. But compared to John Christie, he was like cheese and chalk. And we continued to see Christie after he retired, and we were both terribly sad to see him slowly losing his marbles, which he did.
Mm.
He bought a little house in Henney, Great Henney, on the way to South Colchester there, and he and his wife lived there over a long time. They had two daughters called Catherine and Jane, who are both still going. And Catherine is somebody who gives herself tremendous airs. She's a member of the Athenaeum, one of the first, and she was a magistrate, just like Patricia was a magistrate. And the most amusing thing about John Christie was the Home Guard. And we were having a rehearsal for what would happen if the invasion came. And my job was to cycle up to John Christie's, to a farm where he lived, on the Downs, on the Bromyard Downs. And I went there, fantastic pace, and said, "The invasion started, sir, the invasion started." And he said, "I know, boy, they rang me up." It was a terrible disappointment. But anyway, I think that the school would do well if you could organise an occasional lecture on some of the headmasters. I think that Christie would be a very good one. I think Costley White, who was before Christie, would be interesting. He was still very much the old school. And Christie was sort of half new and half old. And then there was John Carlton. And who's the man who's just retired?
Stephen Spur.
He was good, I think, wasn't he?
It's not for us to say.
Yes, I think, I think what I would say is our headmasters very often are a contrast with their immediate predecessor.
Yes.
And that's probably quite deliberate in some ways. And so, I mean, I wonder what John Christie might have done if the war had not intervened and completely dominated his time as headmaster.
Yes.
As an educational reformer and, yes. And thinker.
Well, have you looked at it?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great book, yes.
Well, we were very keen on doing this book, and the chap who wrote the introduction was a schoolmaster at Malvern, and he wrote extremely well. That's Donald Lindsay.
Yes.
Roger Young and I went to a forestry camp about 1942 in New I can't remember the name.
Newquay?
Newtown. Yeah.
Mm.
And Roger Young was cutting some logs up and put an axe through his leg.
Mm.
I don't know what happened to him afterwards. And Hugh Lloyd-Jones was incredibly brilliant and became professor of classics. Do you think you might just pop next door?
Mm.
If I can have a drink, that would be good. Would you like a drink?
Yes, get one for me. That's probably a good idea. It's the talking, isn't it? Dries your throat out.
I'm getting a bit hoarse.
We interviewed Roger Young recently for the oral history.
Huh?
We interviewed Roger Young.
Oh, did
for
you?
The oral history.
Is he still alive?
About 6 months ago. Yes, I believe so.
What sort of drink would you like?
Lemon juice, please.
Right. What sort of drink can I give you?
Just a glass of water would be lovely.
Water would be lovely.
Just plain water or fizzy water?
Just plain would be lovely.
Plain
just
water.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, tell me about him.
Well, he's living in Bath. And he's a retired head teacher. He was a headmaster.
He's what?
He's a retired headmaster.
Yes.
So he went into teaching
himself.
So
Watson College.
Yes. And yes, I went and interviewed him.
He must be older than me.
Yes. Yes. Not much, a little.
No. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
But I could just tell you about his school days rather than how he is now, because that's the nature of these interviews. We just talk about things that happened, you know, 60 years ago rather than things that happened last week. So
he could of course have become headmaster of Westminster.
Yes, that was the interesting
that's another
thing.
Story.
Well, I think the two contributions, both by Roger Young and Hugh Lloyd-Jones, are not very good. Whereas I thought Tom Lindsay did his job perfectly. But I think it's actually interesting to read some of John Christie's own pieces.
Yes.
I mean, I learnt all about Agape from him. He was a very good sermon preacher. Right,
thank you. Okay. Dear, I can't even keep it dry. Hopeless, aren't I?
There you are.
Thank you.
Let him all where that came from.
Thank you.
Well, what else can I tell you about John Christie?
Yes, it's interesting. You contrasted John Christie and John Carlton. But as you said, your mother got on very well with both of them.
Yes.
Liked both of them personally.
Well, my mother gave up her house in 1940, and in Hampstead Garden suburb. And my father was interned as an enemy alien, first of all in Highton near Liverpool, and then in the Isle of Man, together with all the other German refugees, which was actually a good thing from their point of view, because they all became very friendly with each other. And they all cheated like mad. They were sent tins of coffee, and under the metal lids, there were things that did not have been sent.
Oh.
And they were never. But anyway, my father got released as an artist of eminent distinction, and he became an ambulance driver. Why was I telling you that? No, I mean, going back to John Christie, I think it's really his charisma which is difficult to pin down.
Mm.
He had such a sort of quiet but dominant personality. I don't think he went down very well at Jesus in Oxford, as far as I could judge. There was a lot of criticism of him. But even so, I think he's a towering figure, and it would be a pity if he was forgotten.
Mm.
Somebody could do a book, I mean a lecture out of that book.
I think it's a very good idea. Some sort of headmaster lectures. Sort of headmaster lectures.
You could do one on Busby.
It's interesting because at my school, our annual Founders Day, which I suppose is in some ways the equivalent of Commem. At my school, we used to focus on a previous headmistress each year
At wherever you are.
At our annual Founders Day. But there isn't really an equivalent event at Westminster, or at least...
And I think we do obsessively focus on a very few Westminster headmasters.
Yes.
This is certainly true. And we, a lot of people in the school, completely neglect many others who should be remembered.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things with the way that Christie is remembered in the school, by those by whom he is remembered, I think it's very much taken up with wartime and evacuation and the survival of Westminster just, rather than his qualities as a teacher.
Well,
and as a scholar.
I mean, it wasn't only as a teacher, but he was a wonderful preacher as well. Mm. And his Christianity is quite difficult to focus on. But it was very important to him. As I mentioned, he was always on about agape, which is another Greek word for love, isn't it? Well, does that help you a bit? Do you want to go on?
Yes. I was wondering, because your son was at Westminster, wasn't he?
Paul, yes.
Who was the headmaster when he was in the school?
Oh, the one who went on to encourage alcohol.
Ah, John Ray.
John Ray.
Yes, the Portman Group. What were your impressions of John Ray as a parent?
We thought, as parents, he was bloody hopeless. I mean, Paul had difficulties because he was overloaded with things to take. But we really couldn't. And who was the master of the scholars at the same time?
Was it Jim Cogan?
Huh?
Jim Cogan?
Yes. He was another person who was difficult to get across to. Jim Cogan was a man of very firm convictions. And his principal conviction was that Jim Cogan was always right.
That I do remember.
Did you know him?
Yes, I did, yeah. He could be very awkward if you tried to disagree with him. He certainly wasn't the easiest man always to deal
did
with.
Did you go to Westminster?
Yes, yeah, I'm an old Westminster myself.
Oh, I see. Well, did you know all about it?
Well, something.
When did you go?
In the 1990s, when David Summerscale was the headmaster.
What was he like?
I liked him a lot. I still do. I think he... Oh dear, I'm going to take over this and it's injuring me. I think David Summerscale was a very good headmaster. He was quite subtle in the way that he did things and very much allowed his staff to take the initiative and do what they did best.
Right.
He didn't interfere very much. But... again, I think he spoke to the whole school very well. And he was also very kind on a personal level.
And that's very important.
Which I think does matter. I think pupils notice that.
Well, I think Christie was very kind. Mm. But it was difficult to recognise the kindness behind the sort of charisma.
Mm.
I think he frightened people to some extent.
Yeah.
Well, after that, I spent 9 years at Faber's, and then I went to Methuen's, who were very good on educational books. And my job there was to... their books were very old-fashioned, to modernise them all. And we got taken over by another company, and we became associated book publishers. And it never really melded properly, because the other people were legal publishers, and their parameters were quite different. And I got into hot water. Oh, I rose to dizzy heights. I became director of planning, which was really a wonderful job, as well as looking after production. But the legal people didn't like my great friend, who was called Piers Raymond, to whom I dedicated that book. I don't know why they thought he was so bad, but they sent him on a long journey all round the world, Australia and Africa. And when he came home, there was a letter waiting for him saying, "You're sacked. You're never to come back to the school." And I was absolutely bloody livid and was extremely offensive to them all, saying that was not the way to behave. And so I had to leave in the end. And I took on several jobs in publishing, trying to rescue small publishers. But really, I knew and they knew it was too late. The day of small publishers was over. And you really had to be big and powerful if you could survive. And then I gave up completely and took on the job of writing the Southern History, which I said would take me 7 years. And it did. I collected a huge archive. It took a lorry to take it away. I offered it to Sotheby's, and they said, "Oh, we haven't got room, and we haven't got an archivist." So I gave it to Cambridge University Library, and somebody recently returned a complete index of what there was and looked at it with horror and said how foolish it was of Sotheby's to let everything go. But I put an embargo on the Cambridge University stuff because a lot of very rude personal comments in those books about some people who might still be alive. So people can only look at it in general with my permission, but actually the number is getting more and more frequent for people who want to use it. And then I became a director of Sotheby's, and I did that for 3 or 4 years, looking after all their overseas offices, which was a time when Patricia was chairman of the district council as an independent, which had never happened before, and we just used to see each other over the weekend, because I was always travelling. It doesn't seem much by what they say nowadays, but I travelled 66 times in 15 months, which is a lot.
I think that's a lot.
Yeah. I loved the job. They thought I ought to sack all their overseas agents, but they were all extremely good, but they hadn't been to British public schools, so their attitude was a little bit different. But I was a very good bridge between them and London. And then Sotheby's got into a mess by overexpanding in America. And I joined them on a basis where I didn't have to stay if I didn't want to, although I was being paid a huge amount of money. And so I retired and started Bloomsbury Book Auctions, which was then joined by Lord John Carr, who was head of Sotheby's Book Department. And we worked very happily together for 22 years without ever having a row. And it did very well. So that's really... I retired about 5 years ago. And I've rather enjoyed myself until I fell 2 days ago. I got this ridiculous black eye. It's not part of your story, but I got two different sorts of cancer. And I had most of her colon removed because it was full of tumours, and I've still got prostate cancer. And falling down does shake you up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see what the ridiculous contrast is. Falling down shakes you up. So I don't know whether that's been helpful.
Okay, absolutely.
Keep asking more questions.
I'm going to ask you about the Bloomsbury Book Auctions time. What sort of areas particularly interested you in the...
I was in charge of what were called private treaty sales, which were collections of archives, which Elizabeth would have enjoyed, which were not sold at auction, but where I had to find a buyer. And we did very well. I sold 66 of those for large sums of money. Difficult to budget for, because you never know what was coming. But the best thing we had is we got Graham Greene's entire archive, which he had left to a nephew of his who ran a bookshop near a tube station, I've forgotten what it's called. And curious enough, no English archivist wanted it. And so eventually we sold it to one of three Americans who were all hitting each other to get it. And we sold it to Boston College, who specialise in assembling British Catholic authors. And we sold it for well over £1 million. And the London book dealer had looked at it and said, well, you might get 30,000 for it.
Molly, it's interesting that no one in Britain wanted to buy it.
Well, I tell you what, it was created in a funny way. Graham Greene lived in Nice, and he would dictate the letters, the response to the letters he had, and then he would send them all to London. No, he would send the tape to London, and his sister typed them all out, and he would have signed, you know, several dozen beforehand. And so they all went out. And so, so it was unusual that people didn't have the top copies. They had the sort of carbon copy.
Right.
But which was actually more interesting, because you had the original letter and the answer, and if it carried on. And that was really almost too much for us. I had a brilliant girl who was my assistant, who had been secretary, oh dear, what was the name of Churchill's secretary? A man.
John Colville.
Huh?
Jock Colville? Colville?
No, not him.
Oh, it'll come back to me in a moment.
It's my wife's other
names. Yes.
I'll ask her, I can't remember. Anyway, she brought this archive to us, which had been left to her by the man responsible. She'd organised it brilliantly. So I thought she's going to be good as my assistant. And we used to compile all the sort of catalogues for her. And that worked very well for 5 or 6 years. And then she went on holiday, leaving me lots of those yellow stickers saying, do this and do that. And when she was in France, it was discovered that she had a very advanced form of cancer and never came back. So one is always smitten by these things. Anyway, is Patricia there?
Yes. Shall I go and ask her?
Yes.
Carry on.
Well, I remember quite a bit.
Yeah.
Is that useful to you?
Yes, it's all very useful to us.
Good. Well, it's nice of you to come. I still advise people on what to sell. Mm. And I read this religiously every week.
Yes.
Do you see that?
I get emails from them rather than the hard copy. We tried to bid for something recently, but we were unsuccessful. We didn't...
What were you trying to bid for?
A medal which had Elizabeth I on one side and an epigram written by one of the scholars on the reverse.
Oh, right. What did it go for?
£13,500.
Right.
Quite a considerable sum.
And you thought it might go for eight?
Well, we were hoping that it might go for rather less. But never mind, these things.
Is she coming?
We can't quite think. It's not Brendan Bracken, is it?
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to guess myself here, who worked for Churchill. Patricia said you have to ring Dido, and she will tell you.
Soames did, didn't he? But
Soames
that can't
did.
Be who you mean.
And Brendan Bracken was sort of parliamentary secretary, wasn't he?
Yeah.
She had worked for someone who had been Churchill's secretary.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry to be so. My mother had two sisters, and one of them moved to Switzerland in the early 30s and eventually became Carl Jung's principal assistant. And I kept urging her to write a book about him. Mm. And eventually she did. But Jung was so excited by it that he said, don't worry about that chapter, I'll do it for you over the weekend. And when I heard, I said, for God's sake, get a letter from Jung saying, although he's written that, it's your copyright. And the book came out, and about 5 years ago, it was in his 33rd reprint in New York as a paperback, and it did incredibly well, and the Jung family were absolutely bloody furious.
I can imagine.
And they sort of, although she gave them everything in the end, they were continuously unpleasant, and she was one of those people which you will know from school where you get a sort of instant link, you know, immediately, and she and I sometimes might not correspond for 3 years, but when we talked, we carried on exactly as we had 3 years before, and there's a Swiss man who is doing the life of her, and recently we've been digging out all our correspondence with her. Apparently, which there's very little early stuff. And one of the most interesting things we found was a diary my mother kept when she was 19, at the time when there was a revolution in Berlin. Do you remember Rosa Luxemburg?
Yes, immediately after the first.
And she reports quite calmly, I went out to so-and-so, but I couldn't get help such and such a street because there was too much machine and gunfire, and completely took it in her stride. and mentioned what her sister was doing. And I don't think I've ever read anything which gave an accurate account of what was happening in Germany in 1919. So we've been learning a lot about what's happened then. And I gave a lecture the other day on, it was called a keynote lecture, at a seminar on collecting at the Wallace Collection. And I spoke about a lady called Lady Charlotte Driver, who was a fantastic porcelain collector. And I had to speak for 45 minutes, which was quite an effort for me. And the number of letters I've had since saying, do you know about so-and-so and so-and-so? As if I were a complete mnemonic of everything that ever happened. But that's kept me busy too.
Did all of your family manage to get out of Germany?
Pardon?
Did all of your family manage to get out of Germany?
Certainly not, no. We had a... Do you speak German?
No.
Only a little.
Yeah.
Well, the German for a man who looks after your property is called Verwalter, a sort of local manager.
Mm.
And there was a piece of land we wanted to give to a local manager we then had, because he was, his land was right next to it. And I said, you can have it as long as you do all the paperwork. In Germany, they're very specific about property rights. And he came back to us and said, it's full of difficulties. I would have to clear it with 25 members of your family who have priority rights over me. And we had one fairly close cousin left who was in her 90s. She'd been a bookseller. And we asked her, and she gave us written proof that all 25 of them had died in concentration camps. So that gives you some idea of how things were. And sometimes when I read the files of this, that particular period, I really feel quite sick. So I don't. Mind you, if you look at the paper today, the world's in a funny state.
Were your parents aware of what was going on back in Germany? I mean, obviously they knew enough to want to leave.
I don't know. You know, it's rather like people saying, my father was in the First World War, but he never spoke about it. They never really spoke to me much about it.
Mm.
Or if they did, I don't remember. They must have been aware of it because we have two properties in Germany mentioned in there.
Mm.
One in Bavaria, which is really big. It's got 100 rooms. I still have to look after it. And one in East Germany. And there was the famous Kristallnacht.
Mm.
I think in 1937. When 30 Nazis descended on the one in Bavaria, which was still furnished entirely with antique furniture, with pickaxes and hammers, and smashed everything they could lay their hands on, including, for example, there were 14 beautiful faience stoves, you know, they were. They have them on the continent. And they took enormous pleasure in breaking them all to small pieces. And all the portraits they found, they always put an axe through the head.
Mm.
And we had a nice mayor of that village who made his business to keep a note of everything that was stolen. There were lots of my grandfather was a painter, and his studio was left there intact, more or less. And this chap made a note of where everything was in the way of paintings. And when my father and I went back for the first time in 48 or 49, in our English car, he gave me this list and said, that's where you'll find your grandfather's paintings. So we drove around, and I would come to another village and I would knock on the door, and the man would say, I would open the door, and I would say, my name is Frank Herman. I come from Schloss Bretzfeld. And I've got a list here which says that you're very kindly keeping two pictures of my grandfather. They're both landscapes. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about, in a gruff local accent. I said, it says on my list, they're on the left-hand side of the door in your best drawing room. And he would say, oh, those old things, we don't want them. You can have them back. And in 3 weeks, in the same way, I collected 300 paintings. I wouldn't have the courage to do that now. Mm-hmm. And that's really where he's since become very well known. And that's really where most of the remaining pictures come from. And that's been quite a big task, to keep his memory alive with exhibitions, mm-hmm. which we did many of, my brother and I, but we both feel a bit exhausted.
You also, in the book, you write about going back to the property in East Germany, and what
yes.
was East Germany, and the state that it was in, the restoration work that had to be done. Was that something that meant a great deal to you?
Well, I've sort of got a natural belief that it's no good having a ruin. And we were able to use the profits we made in the other place, which was let out to Siemens, the electronic firm, for 60 years, to rebuild the one in the east. And my brother and I went there, and we found it in a fearful state. We found a builder, and we found a man to look after it. And we gradually did it up by dint of the fax machine, which they'd never had before in Germany. So every week we had a session of what needed to be done. And there are pictures there, did you see them?
Yes, yeah.
It was absolutely awful. But we managed over a year to get the whole thing going. And then I found I needed a new Verwalter, because the original one had got a bit old. And so we took on a girl who was only 23, and she's been there for, I think, 18 years now, and looks after it extremely well. So that was a good thing. And I used to go there fairly frequently, and my brother kept saying, it's the most expensive bed and breakfast I've ever heard of. I haven't been able to go recently. I went still last year. It's a lovely place in the middle of huge forests, and it's quite different scenery from the one in Bavaria. And the girl who's working here is going there on a brief holiday at the end of this week, to give her family a break. So we do still use it. Mm. And tell me, how many children are there at how many pupils are there at Westminster nowadays?
We're now nearly 750.
Where on earth do you put them all?
Well, that's a good question. We have acquired a number of new buildings in recent years. And we wouldn't have been able to expand in numbers so far otherwise. But it can get a bit crowded. But we've got new teaching blocks and facilities, which makes a huge difference.
It's what?
It makes a huge difference.
Yes.
Because we've got this new building in Dean's Yard.
Have we changed them all?
Well, no, is the answer. A.A. Milne has paid for some of them. And our new sports centre, I think I'm allowed to say, has not entirely been paid for yet.
In Westminster Square?
Yeah.
Yes. Did you visit Westminster after the war, with your mother teaching there and your brother as a pupil? Or were you just up in Oxford?
Because I was at Oxford for the first year. No, I mean, one of the amazingly... not exactly worrying, but irritating things. That here I am, 87, and I've never in my life had so many invitations to parties and exhibitions and things, and I can't go to them. There are two or three a week. So it's nice to be known, but sad not be able to follow up. What's the time?
Ooh, nearly 1 o'clock.
Oh, well, it's nearly lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Is there anything else you wanted to ask?
I think we were going to ask. I mean, it's more if you might have heard from your brother at Westminster after the war, because, of course, there were a number of new masters who came to teach at Westminster.
Yes.
In the late 1940s, including a number of masters who came from Germany, who came as refugees from Europe, Adolf Prague and Hugo Garten,
what were they?
Ernst Sanger.
Say it again.
Prague, Garten,
Sanger.
Do you remember hearing about them at all?
We've got an archive report from them.
Well, not them personally, but of course we have been in touch with some of their families, I think, because Adolf Prague died a few years ago. But I was just wondering if your brother had said anything about them within the school and the way that the school perhaps changed with those new masters from a very different perspective.
No, I think you ought to go and interview him.
I think perhaps we should. Yeah. I think that's maybe the next step.
Where does he live? Is he...
In Wales.
Oh, which part of Wales?
Usk.
Oh, that's not too far from me in the holidays, so yes, we should.
If you go into my... in next door, and then take the door on the left, there's a desk in front of you, and if you open a drawer on the right-hand side, you'll find there's a red booklet there. It's got all my addresses in it. If you can manage.
I'll try and remember.
Shall we put this on hold for now, Elizabeth?
Do you want to pause it?
Yeah.
Is it okay?
Is that off or on?
On.
Go on.
Just to finish off.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's the main... the maddening thing, one forgets it, and then 10 minutes later it comes back.
That happens to me too, though. I don't think it's entirely related with age.
Happens to me a lot.
Oh, well, I think it is, yes. Now, I took a terrible toss falling down these stairs. I've been going up and down them in a fairly ill state for 5 years. I've never done it before. As you can see, and we probably haven't told you that on the 18th, Patricia and I were married 60 years.
I saw all the cards.
That's what all those are. And we had the whole family here, our children and grandchildren, and my brother and his wife, and Patricia's twin sister. And there were 22 of us. But I felt a bit knocked out, but it all went very well, very well.
Did you have a letter from the Queen? Is it the 60th you can have a letter from the Queen? You might not want a letter from the Queen.
We've got to be 100.
Yes, I thought she did ones for wedding anniversaries as well. I'm sure she did when my grandparents had theirs.
Well, you better organise it.
Yes, you get in touch with her.
I have to write to her, because that's what you have to do now, don't you? You have to apply. There you go.
Oh, right, yes. Well, Patricia's got an OBE.
Oh, well, that's better then. That really trumps it.
That's better than a letter. Better than a card or a letter.
Yes. Well, she was a magistrate for many, many years, and she was also a district councillor. She was the first independent district councillor who was chairman of the council. Mm. And she was doing that when I was doing the Sotheby director job of overseas operations. And I can't remember that I told you before, but we only used to meet over the weekends. And she did terribly well. She still runs four different committees.
That's good.
Actually, she gave up one yesterday because it's being closed down.
Oh.
It was a wonderful thing where the government allowed a percentage of the places where you tip your rubbish to be used to support local things, like church halls or playing fields.
Oh, the money.
And Patricia had been doing that for years and years. But I think they're now going to stop doing it because there isn't enough money about. Mm.
Yes, the cuts.
Sign of the times. Mm. Right.
Well, thank you so much
for
talking to us.
Do you want to move?
Just stop the tape. Okay.